Good morning. I asked to speak today on this topic because it's one that I've been thinking about for a while, and perhaps I might say working up my nerve to speak about. As an educator married to a rabbi, there are things that make it very fraught to speak in public at all on any topic that includes the word tuition. For starters, to be perfectly frank about it, my salary is paid by the tuitions that hardworking parents pay, and therefore there is always something of a little bit of a fraught or tense dynamic when parents speak to us, the educators, about tuition. I understand that. I also understand that we, the educators, perhaps are positioned to have a perspective on this that's worth our sharing. In terms of my husband being a rabbi, somebody wrote an angry anonymous piece for the Times of Israel, which maybe describes a lot of pieces written for the Times of Israel. Somebody wrote an angry anonymous piece for the Times of Israel about how they found their way to doing Jewish for much less money than we might think of that it costs to do Jewish. One of the ways they found to do Jewish for much less money was pulling their kids out of yeshivot. But in the course of that article, the author launched quite the diatribe against rabbis, rabbinic salaries, and what one might call rabbinic privilege, saying that rabbis, the figure he cited was $350,000 a year. Rabbis with a $350,000 a year salary, paid for housing, and free tuition for their children don't understand how the rest of the hardworking Jewish community lives as they struggle to pay the shul dues that are securing those rabbis in the lap of luxury. I would like to make a general announcement that if you know of a shul that is paying its rabbi $350,000 a year and providing housing and free tuition, I would very much appreciate if you could give my husband that information. Rabbis aren't getting paid that. Covered housing and free tuition are increasingly not part of the rabbinic package. Schools that give educators tuition discounts are generally not giving them free tuition also. We also pay tuition for our kids in their various schools. So I guess, imchem anochi b'tzara, we are standing, at least to some extent, in the same shoes that you are standing in. So this is not a case of my floating along in my privilege telling you what you are, you know, working hard to underwrite. But it's also a case, again, as I said when I started, where I think that there's something meaningful that I have to say here. This talk grew out of a question that I was asked when I was a Stalin resident in a community in which they said, we are working really hard to send our kids to yeshiva day schools. We see the enormous value in that. We want to be doing the work we're doing and paying the tuition we're paying to make sure that our kids get this kind of education. But a lot of kids whose parents are working hard and paying tuition and getting this education don't seem to end up where their parents would want them to end up, said the askers in this community. They said, we're not complaining about the day schools. We're asking, what can better our odds? What can give us better odds of getting the outcomes that we want from this enormous investment that we are making? That actually struck me as a really great question, as a question that I'm not sure anyone ever asked me before, certainly not framed in that particular way. So I've been thinking about it. And I have some things from my vantage point, having been in high school education in various parts of the Orthodox community for close to 20 years now. I have some thoughts as to what might help us increase our odds. I'd like to share them this morning. But the first thing that I want to say is that there are no magic bullets. I am not offering you a guarantee. This is not like the clickbait pop-ups you see on the internet. This one crazy trick will help you lose 15 pounds overnight. This one crazy trick will ensure that your child turns out like the kind of frum Jew you want them to be. There's no one crazy trick. There's no guarantee. I'm not giving you the magic bullet that's going to make it all work. First of all, the most important thing that we learn over the course of parenting is that our kids are the people they are, with the personalities they have, with the brain chemistry that they have, with the life experiences that they have, and there is a great deal there that is outside of our control. There's a great deal there that we can't particularly do anything about. You can't do everything right, many parents have, and still have kids who challengingly, painfully, disappointingly turn out differently than you would have hoped. We also see plenty of parents that, to be brutally frank, we don't think are doing everything right, and their kids turn out like perfectly lovely, well-adjusted human beings. Why that is, I don't know. If I had the answer to that, you know, I'd be bottling it and sharing it. But none of this is meant to say that this is the magic bullet answer that's going to give you the guarantees. But again, I do think there are things you can do that can improve your odds. And I would like to share them with you. And the very first thing that I'd like to say to you that I think can improve our odds grows precisely out of what I just said, which is that each of our children is the person he or she is, with their own brain chemistry, with their own personality, with their own life experiences. You know, in Pirkei Avot, we're told about various people, hu haya omer. So that doesn't mean that's the only thing he said. It means that's the thing he repeated over and over and he was known by. So if I have a hu haya omer, a thing that I repeat over and over to the point where maybe I'm known by it, it is this. I say that from my however many years, I should figure out exactly how many years it is so I can quote an exact number. From my however many years working in education, I have come to see that short of abuse and neglect, leaving out abuse and neglect, there is only one type of bad parenting. And it comes in a million different flavors and varieties, but there is only one type of bad parenting. And that is that you cannot accept that your child is the person he or she is, not the person you would have wanted them to be. Our children are not our mini-me's. They are not little models of ourselves that we create and send out into the world. We have deeply held values. We have things that we care about, things that we want to transmit. I will talk more about that later. And we can educate towards those things, and we should. But don't get caught up. Don't get so caught up in trying to create your child as the precise little mini-me, occupying the exact position on the political spectrum, the religious spectrum, in employment, in education, in the community, that you would like to see them occupy, to the point that that becomes destructive. My father is a child and adolescent psychologist. He practices in Brooklyn, New York. For a long time, maybe even still now, a meaningful fraction of his practice was made up of more yeshivish people who came from Lakewood, New Jersey to see my father in Brooklyn, either because they didn't want to see a therapist in Lakewood, there weren't enough therapists in Lakewood, they were afraid of being seen going to a therapist in Lakewood. I have very clear memories of at some point hearing my father say that he was seeing a teenage boy and his father for whom the presenting point of fighting, alienation, whatever it was that the teenage boy didn't want to wear a black hat, and his father wanted to insist that he wore a black hat. So we could listen to that and say, ha ha ha, isn't that ridiculous? You're going to fight with your kid to the point that this becomes such a bone of contention that you need to see a therapist over the wearing of a black hat. It's very easy on when it's someone else's issue, where someone else is on the spectrum, to see how that's silly. But I would ask us to think about ourselves, whether we similarly can get so invested in things that seem to us to be important indications of where our kid is religiously, or where they associate politically, or communally, or whatever else it is, get so caught up in those things, which are in fact very trivial, even though they seem to us important at the time when we're butting heads with a stubborn adolescent, that we are actually doing the same thing in a different arena. When I spoke with my mother about what I wanted to say this morning, she reminded me that she had heard me speak about a completely different topic in a completely different context in which I offered a metaphor that might be relevant here. I said, oh, it's good you remember that I said that, because I didn't remember that I said that, but it's actually a good metaphor here. By academic training, I'm an historian of science. That's what I study. So in history of science, when you talk about taxonomy, classifying organisms, on, you know, that whole tree of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, and what organisms are related to what, and those Latin names, right? So when they first started classifying organisms way back in the 18th century, they classified them based on how they looked. If two butterflies looked pretty similar, they were assumed to kind of be close together on the tree, right? And if things looked pretty different, they were assumed to be far apart on the tree. And that's how they classified them, based on how they looked, based on their structures. But then, much later on, when we were able to do genetic testing, we were able to discover that sometimes organisms that look very similar are, in fact, genetically very different. They're actually not closely related at all. They independently may have evolved similar appearance, but they're actually not related very closely at all. And sometimes organisms that look very, very different, they present physically very differently, but actually genetically they're very closely related. So I actually want to ask us, if even if fighting to the death with your teenage child about wearing a black hat sounds to us like something that's very distant from us, whether there is anything that even if it presents differently is genetically very similar. In the sense that it represents a parent so wanting to produce a child who looks just like me, who is just like me, that I kind of lose sight of the fact that there is an individual in front of me and that she is the person she is or he is the person he is. And my job is not to try to cut and snip and stretch and tailor them into being an exact reflection of me. I'm going to tell you two specific examples that I myself have encountered. One is, I have encountered more than one student who has been told, there is some trust fund to pay for college for you, or your grandparents will pay for college for you, but only if you go to this specific school. And I've been told that in multiple directions, both only if you go to the Ivy League, there's money available to pay for school for you, but only if you go to an Ivy, there's money available to go to school for you, but only if you go to YU. Whatever it is, there is money to pay for college for you that you will only get if you go to this school that all your grandparent thinks is the right school for you. Now, there's a lot to say about our values and the things we want to pass on to our kids, our religious values. We think that going to a Jewish school is the best thing for our kid. But when you say to a child, I'm not interested in hearing who you are or what you want or what you need or what you think you need. I know what you need, and I'm going to tell you what it is. And if you do what I want you to do, I'll pay for it. And if you don't do what I want you to do, I won't pay for it. You're not listening to the person in front of you, to the person he or she is. And that, I think, has the potential to be very harmful. And I've seen this, again, go both ways. I've seen this with parents who were upset because their kids weren't from enough, and I've seen it with parents who were upset that their kids were too from, and I've seen it with every possible axis that you could think of. But the underlying common denominator is I want my kid to reflect me precisely, and it's hard for me to hear that my child is the person he or she is, making the choices he or she is making, going in the direction he or she is going. Again, this doesn't mean we don't have principles or deeply held values. We'll come back to that. It does. But it also means that we understand that not everything that we do is a reflection of those deeply held values, right? A black hat is not a reflection of deeply held values. It's a reflection of communal identification, and maybe my child wants to communally identify a little differently. And there are other things that I might want or not want, but in the big scheme of things, it doesn't strike at the core of my values. And if my child wants something different, and making space for them to be who they are, accommodating them in their themness is going to help them be happy, engaged, fully realized people. I say you can't make your kid be who you want them to be. The only thing you can do is make them miserable. If you make your kid miserable, the odds of them being positively aligned with the values that you are conveying, with the values the school you are sending them to is conveying, all of that, you know, kind of goes down considerably. So that's the first thing. The first thing is to understand that our children are the people they are, and as much as we want to transmit to them fundamental values, to understand that we have to do that in a way that is responding to, engaging with, hearing, and dealing with the people who stand in front of us, not with some abstract sense of us stamping out human beings who reflect exactly who and what we are. So that's the first thing I want to say globally about maximizing the return on our investment. A second thing that I want to say globally about maximizing the return on our investment, this is much more prosaic, and that is, we have to send kids to schools that we respect. Respect does not have to mean agree with all the time. It will not harm your child's chinuch at all if you say to your child, I understand the school does this, we as a family do that, here's why we do something different than the school. That will not undermine your child's chinuch at all. What will undermine your child's chinuch is hearing you cynically or contemptuously dismiss the educators who are supposed to be teaching your child. Whether you say that directly to your kids or not, kids are much smarter than we give them credit for. They pick up a lot more than we give them credit for. Their little ears, their little antennae are always tuned. They're taking in all kinds of things. And the casual conversation you have around the Shabbos table with the other neighbors from the community, where we do sometimes engage in the casual sport of knocking down the rabbi or knocking down the school principal, because that's like a fun thing to do around the Shabbos table, you think that what your kid hears from that is, like, basically, I fundamentally respect the whole enterprise, but I don't like this thing that the principal or the rabbi did, and it's like always kind of, you know, fun to take pot shots. What your kid may hear from that is that the enterprise is corrupt, that it's represented by people who are hypocrites, that it's fundamentally not worth engaging or investing in. Again, respecting is not about agreeing all the time. It's not. And it's not going to hurt your kid at all if you say we do things differently. There's not going to be any school that aligns entirely and perfectly with who you are, what you think. But picking the school that you respect, whose school leaders you respect, whose school values you respect, means that you will convey to your child that approach of respect even when you disagree. And then your child will grow up understanding that this enterprise is respect worthy, which will help them get more out of it. It's true, by the way, about seeking out a shul rav whom you respect also. If you're coming home from shul every Shabbos to sit around and engage in Shabbos table fun and take potshots at the rabbi, that's not good for your kid's religious development. It's not. Because again, you think they hear, oh, this particular rabbi is X, Y, and Z. They may hear the rabbinate is X, Y, and Z, and rabbis are X, Y, and Z, and the Torah they teach is X, Y, and Z, and halacha they teach is X, Y, and Z. And so Chazal tell us that lag echad dochem mea tochachot. One mockery knocks away 100 reproofs, 100 rebukes. That you can 100 times have a serious moment of musar and talk to somebody for what they're doing wrong and reprove them and guide them. And one mockery, mimicking the rabbi, mimicking the teacher, making fun of them, takes away the weight of 100 reproofs. Your child is not going to hear that person's Torah teaching, that person's musar, that person's ethical instruction the same way after they've heard you mimic or mock them. And so it's really, really important that we avoid that. My mother, who has been an educator, it's actually her 50th year. It's also actually her 50th year in the same school, which is kind of staggering. My mother does not understand her kids who changed jobs. She doesn't know what changing jobs is. She started in one place right after college, and she's still there. She's like, what are you changing jobs for? Even not just like in education, like, oh my gosh, you're abandoning the school and the students. I have a sister who works for financial firms. And when she left for American Express to go to Goldman Sachs, I think my mother felt bad, like, how are you doing this to American Express? And my sister was like, that's not how it works. They would fire me in a minute if they thought they needed to. People pick up and leave all the time. It's not like that. But my mother doesn't know anything about changing jobs. She's been in the same place for 50 years. But my mother says that cynicism is the avi avot hatum'ah of education. What does avi avot hatum'ah mean? What does it mean to be the most tamei sort of thing? It means you're not only mitamei, you don't make other things impure directly by contact, but even secondarily and tertiarily, you pass along that tum'ah. That cynicism, that mocking dismissal, makes it much harder for your children to get something of value for the educational institution. And again, that applies to religious leaders more broadly. Find someone you respect. Disagreeing with them is totally fine. I want to say two more things about this. The first is that's much easier to do in the New York area where we have lots and lots of choices. I'm not blind to the fact that if you live in what New Yorkers globally call out of town, you may find yourself in a community in which there is only one Jewish school in your community, in which you don't have the choice of this school or that school or that school, and I can find the school whose leaders I respect, whose values I align with, that's really the place that I want to have my child. And that may make all this more challenging, but I think also all the more important then, to think about when you don't necessarily see yourself entirely aligned with the school leader or with the community rabbi for that matter. How do you talk about them to and in front of your children? How do you talk about them to other people? And again, the message your child is hearing may not be the message you intend to give. The message you intend to give may be this particular person is a bozo. The message your child may hear may be about the entire enterprise. And the last thing I want to say about this is if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. You ever hear that? It's true about schools also. Sometimes, for whatever reason, you need to send your child to a different school than you might have planned to send them to. They have various kinds of special needs, and the school that you would see as most aligned with your values is not the school that meets those needs. it becomes clear to you that who your child is and where they are religiously or personally, they want to be in a different school than the one you would have wanted them in, to the right or to the left, that your child's particular constellation of who they are-ness requires that they be in a different school than the one you might initially have chosen. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. Needling at that school because your child said that they wanted to go to a more centrist or a more right-wing school, to a more left-wing school than the one you would have chosen because your child's needs require they be in this particular school, whatever the issue is, needling at that school undermines whatever you hope to gain by placing your child in an educational environment that's better suited to meet their needs. And again, no one's pretending that this is easy. Watching your child in an educational institution that may not be perfectly aligned with where you would want them to be, because for whatever reason that's where your child needs to be, that is a lot of the work of parenting. That's what we have to do. But again, but undermining that is just not helping your child's learning experience, and ultimately it's not helping your child's ability to take in the values and messages that the educational institution is conveying. So that's the second thing that I want to say about improving our odds. Here's the third thing I want to say about improving our odds, and I believe that I first heard this articulated in this form by Rabbi Leonard Matanky, who's the head of the Ida Crown School in Chicago and also a shul rabbi in Chicago. And I heard him speak, I think at a Champions Gate conference that I was at a long time ago. And he said, we talk to our kids all the time about the day-to-dayness of school life. We teach them what we teach them in a halacha class, in a chumash class, in a gemara class. He said, we never back up and say to them, it's crucially important that you marry a Jew. That it's essential that wherever you find yourself exactly in the community, that you're Shomer Shabbos, Kashrus, and Taharas HaMishpacha, because those are the defining things of an observant Jew. And even if we talk to you all the time about this nuance or that nuance or that particular halachic value, that particular halachic value, here are the biggest things that matter the most. He was saying it to educators, but I heard it as a parent as well. If I charted how many times in a given week I said to my children, clean up your room, take your dish off the table and put it in the sink. Did you do your homework? Did you do your homework? Did you do your homework? Why didn't you do your homework? And how many times I sat down with my children to say, these are our most deeply held values as a family, as Jews, as Americans, as Zionists, as whatever it is. These are the things we care the most about. These are the things we want you to care the most about. Trust me, the scale would bend way over to the side of, you know, did you clean your room? Did you do your homework? Put your dish in the sink. I don't expect it ever to be equally balanced. My children would also think it was very funny if every time I said, did you do your homework, I also said, let me talk to you about some of my most deeply held religious values. But at least at some point, we should consciously make spaces and times to have those conversations. We should not assume that our children are picking that stuff up from the air or kind of imbibing it or kind of. If our kids don't hear very clearly from us what we value, what we want, what we think is right, they may walk away not knowing. And we may be combining shocked and stunned, so I can't get either word out. We may be shocked and stunned by that. How could you have grown up in my house for 18 years and not known how I felt about X or Y or Z? It seems impossible to believe that. Everything we did reflected our deep commitments to X or Y or Z. I know, but you never told me. You never told me. I think we have to tell them. We have to say explicitly, here are things we value and care about as a family. Here are things we value and care about as individuals. Although, particularly when you're parenting teenagers, which I'm now doing with three different teenagers, particularly when you're parenting teenagers, you sometimes think they never hear a thing you say, or even more, that they actively choose to ignore everything you say. Studies are very clear that when you ask teenagers about what shapes their values in all kinds of areas, more than their friends and more than their school and more than everything else, they say their parents, even if they sound like they're completely ignoring every word that comes out of our mouths. And therefore, if we want to increase our odds that the message that our children are getting from school will be met with success, a part of that is having that reinforced, not just passively. Of course we care about Frumkeit. We're a Frum family. Of course we care about Torah learning. We're a family that pays a lot of money for you to go to yeshiva so you can learn Torah. We're actually going to actively say, these are values that we have. These are things that we think are important. These are things that we care about. I'm going to tell you a story. It involves my oldest son. The odds are like this. About half the people I tell this story to think it's proof positive that I'm insane. The other half of people I tell the story to think that it's amazing. And then the last time I told the story in public, one person, in the context of a different talk, one person came over to me afterwards and said, I actually think it's both insane and amazing. So I'm the overlap of the Venn diagram. So here's a story about actually articulating deeply held values. My son has the lot in life of being the child of both a rabbi and a communal educator. Two people who are professionally, publicly Jews. Doesn't get, you know, it's not an easy space in which to grow up and go through your adolescence and navigate your own identity. And he sometimes found himself challenged by the expectations that all of that places upon him. This tends to come to a head every year on Yom Kippur, which isn't an easy day anyway, and then you put someone in shul for 10 hours of what's supposed to be an intense emotional religious experience, and it can be challenging. And so I've had this experience already with my son a number of years, and by now he's past it. He's a big kid, but in his sort of more turbulent adolescent years, I had this experience with him a number of times. We'd be walking home from shul during the break on Yom Kippur, and he would just uncork all of his frustrations and upsetnesses and everything else. So we were walking home from shul on Yom Kippur, and he's telling me about all of this, what he's not into and doesn't like and doesn't want and isn't on board with. I was getting the whole rundown, the whole litany. I think the first time I heard it, I was horrified. I was very taken aback. And then by the second year, I was like, okay, this is a pattern. He's like basically on board with the program. He's a great kid. And once a year, he feels really frustrated and all comes out. We'll be okay here. And by this year, it must have been at least the third year, because I was able to engage in the conversation around it. And he's sort of expressing all this. And I said to him, look, when you're an adult, you're going to choose who you want to be. You're going to choose what you want to do. And I'm not going to have control over that anymore. I'm not going to be able to tell you this is what you have to be or this is what you can't be. I said to him, whatever you choose to do, whoever you choose to be, whatever choices you make, whether the choices I would have chosen or not, whether the choices that I'm hoping that you make or not, whatever you choose to do, I'll still love you. You'll still be my son, and I'll still love you. Then I thought about it some more, and I said, unless your wife wants a get, and you hold her in aguna, then I won't love you anymore. So there are people who hear this, and they're like, okay, you're off your rocker, lady. Frida doesn't think I'm off my rocker. There are people who hear this and think you're off your rocker, lady. Some of you will doubtless fall into that camp. But you know what? When do we ever say to our sons, particularly to our male children, it is an affirmative value that we hold very dear that you never engage in this particular abuse of halacha? We don't. And then when it happens, when the marriage falls apart and when things get ugly, and it sometimes occurs that way, we marshal over and we send people to protest and chant outside the house. But that's actually something probably that we value and that we never communicate a value about. So if you don't want to do it my way because you think my way is bonkers, no problem, do it your way. I know a family where after there was a very ugly fight over Yerusha, over an inheritance from a grandparent, in which the family was essentially torn apart by it, over an inheritance fight, one of the parents said the same thing to her children. I want you to know now, I'm telling you now, while I'm alive and hale and hearty and you're all young, that whatever happens after I die, here's what I want not to happen. I want not to happen a fight over inheritance that tears the family apart. So there are things, that's obviously not a fundamental value. A fight over an inheritance that tears a family apart. Now that's not as fundamental a value, but there are many things that we think are implicit, that we don't convey explicitly, that we don't say straight out to our kids. And the truth is that when we're raising our kids to be from Jews, we are asking many, many, many things of them all the time. It's probably worth being clear at some point what we think are the most important. What we think are the most important. What we hope wherever you go in life and whatever you choose, that you hold on to these things as kind of like the non-negotiables. And then the rest of it, our kids are who they are and they're going to turn out how they turn out. So that's another thing I think that improves our odds, is actually being super clear with our children about what those values are that we hope that they will uphold in their lives. Not expecting them just to pick it up from the air in our homes, but to say it straight out. Here's another one. This is called walking the walk. The following is a thing that happened. A father called my colleague, Ms. Lisa Schlaff, who's the director of Judaic Studies at SAR High School. And he said, "What are you people doing over there in that school of yours? I can't get my son out of bed to go to Minyan on Sunday morning. What are you teaching them? How are you being mechanech them? Is this what I'm paying all of my tuition dollars for? He doesn't get out of bed for Minyan on Sunday morning." I actually think Lisa said this. I don't even think she just thought this. I think she actually said this. "Well, could you just help me understand the context? Do you go to Minyan on Sunday morning?" No. Okay, let me explain something to you. That's not going to work, right? It's not going to work that we tell your kids from Monday to Friday, from 9 to 5 or from 8 to 5 or however many hours we have them in school about the importance and the value of tefillah and tefillah betzibur, but they don't see that modeled, that they're going to take it from us. This has to be an immersive 360-degree, 24/7 environment of which school can only provide so much. It is reasonable to expect school to provide a lot of it, and we try to. Increasingly, not only in the realm of education, of text, of skills, but also in the realm of lived Jewish experience, of the Shabbatonim, of the activities, of the Ruach. High schools, all high schools are doing more and more and more of that, trying to give kids a much broader Jewish experience and Jewish engagement than just learning text and Sfarim. But as much as we give and as much as we can do, it needs to be in the context of a broad environment that supports and reinforces the values and the practices that we are giving over. And this comes up in many, many, many different ways, right? It comes up in the halachic realm. If you want us to teach your kids certain values, certain behaviors, certain whatever it is, and then on vacation or over Pesach, in Miami or in Cancun or in Arizona or in Utah or in Bangkok or wherever they are, you convey to your children that different standards obtain or different standards apply, then when they come back to me after vacation or after Pesach and I say to them again whatever I say to them, they understand that that's not what the family thinks or values, even if you never said to them that's not what we think or value. But that has to be a consistent message. If you say to your kids, "What I value most for you is that you end up being a certain type of frum Jew," and then when it comes time to the college, for the college conversation, the college decision, you say, "What's the highest ranked school on the U.S. News and World Report ranking that we can get into? That's the school we're shooting for," then those other conversations are not going to bear fruit because they are not backed up by walking the walk. If you say to your child, "What matters very much to us as religious Zionists is an environment that's conducive to and supportive of your love for and engagement with Israel," and then when it comes to the college application process, the only thing you say is how high up the rankings of the U.S. News and World Report is this school, instead of saying, "What's the climate and the conversation around Israel like on this campus?" So then your child hears, "Yeah, those things are all values, but like, we get what's trumping all those other values." And there's only so much that the educational institution can do to give that over, to make that happen, when the message that children are hearing is a message of, "This is all very important and this all matters a great deal, but only so far." And then something else comes into play. And again, this applies across the board at whatever level and in whatever place you're at. Whatever it's about in terms of the college or post-high school decisions, whatever it's about in terms of the vacation, what we do in our spare time decisions, you can be in a much more right-wing school where the issue is not, you know, going to Puerto Vallarta on vacation, but the issue is the school gives across one kind of message about consuming popular culture, and then I take my kids to R-rated movies on the weekends, and it's all the same thing. If you'd like your kids to really get the most out of the messages the schools are giving, then to some extent you have to be maintaining that with a consistent environment the rest of the time. And again, if you think the messages the schools are giving are like out to lunch, then probably, at least in the New York area, you have the option of putting your kid in another school where you don't think the messages are as out to lunch. But have your kid in a situation in which they're hearing one kind of message 5 days a week and another kind of message at other times, and then wondering why the message that the school's giving over doesn't seem to be taking root more effectively. I think that's why. Or that can be a part of why. I want to say one final thing about this. And this, I think, is actually a whole other long topic of conversation, but I'm going to say it now briefly. I think we have to communicate to our children more that sometimes trade-offs have to be made. And I think that for many of us, the understanding of what it means to be modern Orthodox, and I use that term broadly to encompass the centrist world as well, what it means to be a Jew who engages with the broad world is to be somebody who manages to do everything. So I had the following conversation with my students, because I love testing. When I have a theory, I like testing it against them. That's my real world test. I said to them, if we were telling you a story about, let's say, a high school basketball team that was competing in a tournament that wasn't a Jewish tournament, in a secular tournament, and the tournament required them to play on Shabbos, and we wanted to tell you the story with an inspirational feel-good ending, what would the inspirational feel-good ending to that story be? And my students all said, I'll let you guess. What would the inspirational feel-good ending to that story be in a modern Orthodox school? Basketball tournament, supposed to play on Shabbos, they can't play on Shabbos. What's the feel-good ending to that story? They changed the time and the kids got to play, right? That's the story we tell all the time. There was a story a few years ago about, I think, some mock trial tournament somewhere in the South. You know, you get a frum kid who's, you ever so often hear about a frum kid who's excelling in some particular sport or some area of something. And the feel-good story that we tell in our community is they were able to do both. They were able to pull it both off. They were able to be committed, observe and choose, and they were able to play in the tournament, compete in the mock trial, whatever it was. I said, it's interesting because we don't really tell inspirational feel-good stories about, so they didn't get to compete, so they forfeited, so they lost. But it was like more important, right? We don't like to tell that story. We don't like to tell a story about choices and trade-offs. I don't think that's a story we tell our kids as an inspirational story. The inspirational stories we tell are about having everything, about being able to do both. Be committed in your frumkeit, be committed in your observance, be committed in your orthodoxy, and be able to play ping pong in the Olympics or whatever it is. We like to tell stories about people who do both. And we maybe need to be a little bit more honest or upfront that sometimes trade-offs are required, or sometimes, dare I say, sacrifices are required. I once spoke about this somewhere. I talked about what I called the modern Orthodox ethic of sacrifice. I said I thought we needed a little bit more of an ethic of sacrifice in our community. I got a lot of pushback. People do not like the word sacrifice. Man, does that rub people the wrong way. I don't know. Like, sometimes it can't all work. And when it can't all work, when it comes head to head, what are we telling our children what trumps what? I can give you a number of specific examples. I do not mean to say, I want to say this super clearly, I do not mean to say that in any one of these cases it can't be worked out. Lots of things can be worked out. I mean to say that when it can't be worked out, how do we talk about it and how do we communicate around that? I want to visit exotic locale A or B or C, but it's difficult or impossible to find kosher food in exotic locale. Or I don't know how I'm going to do Shabbos in exotic locale. So there are a number of possible endings to that story, right? One might be, okay, I don't go to exotic locale. Another ending might be, I go with a suitcase full of tuna fish. Another ending might be, well, it's only this and it's only that, and if I buy this in a restaurant and I buy that in a restaurant, it's probably kind of okay, and I wouldn't really eat that at home, but wherever I am in exotic locale, that's what we need to do to be able to make it work out, and to be part of this community is both to be able to be an observant, committed Jew and visit an exotic locale, so that's what's going to need to be done to make it work. Same thing is true about the college conversation, right? Do we ever say that school is just like not a good place? I don't mean not a good place for frum life because it doesn't have kashrus or it doesn't have Shabbos or it doesn't have a minyan. My students are perfectly capable of saying I'm not going to that school because it has no Jewish life like that. But I mean the next level. There's something particularly about being in that institution for 4 years that I think is going to undermine my halachic practice or my Jewish values. So is the success story ever, okay, so I'm not going to go there, even if it seems attractive, even if it seems compelling? Or is the success story always going to be I'm going to go and I'm going to work it out, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work? I think there are many similar examples that we can offer. Pursuing various kinds of sports and arts at a high level often becomes another one of them. And I wonder if we ever communicate to our kids clearly and directly, that being part of this enterprise that we have chosen to be part of and that we find to be a meaningful, important, rewarding, and God-ordered way of running our lives also means that sometimes there are things we can't do. There's stuff we say no to. I know you're going to say to me, oh, we say no to them all the time. The Shabbos and Kashrus are stuff we say no to them about all the time. And that's, of course, true. But in certain areas, I think we push a little too hard on the working it out and making both things happen, where if we were a little bit clearer up front with that there are trade-offs, there are things that happen and don't things that can and can't, then maybe when it comes to some of the bigger things that are a little bit more challenging, we've already inculcated a sense that sometimes our values require us to, sometimes our commitment, sometimes halacha, requires us to make these kinds of decisions and these kinds of trade-offs, and in doing so, we maximize the chance that our educational investment is going to pay off. We maximize the chance our educational investment is going to pay off. And we are also modeling for our children and giving our children a set of tools that they are going to need in their entire lives as from Jews. That's not just a decision that comes up once when I have to decide if I'm going to play in the tournament or what college I'm going to go to. These are a set of tools that they're going to need with them for their whole lives. I want to conclude where I started, which is that I am not silly enough to think that there is anything that gives you a guarantee with your own children. My own experience with my own children, who are all the products of the same parents, growing up in the same homes, and as different as they could be from one another. They're also all in different schools, because they're all very different from one another. They need different things, they want different things, they are different people. There's no guarantee that's going to wave the magic wand and turn all of our kids out exactly the way we hope they turn out. I think saying that or selling that is selling false hope. But I think there are things that we can do that increase the odds, that give us a better chance. And I think some of the things that we can do that give us a better chance are figuring out both how we engage in a partnership with the school that is a meaningful and productive one, and that's by sending our kids to schools that we respect and about whom that we can speak respectfully, and working to make sure that what happens at home is reinforcing the values of the school rather working against them. And there are also things we can do to help our children grow and become as who they are along the paths they have to take without trying to force them into some pre-existing model that we've decided that they all need to fit into, because it is in fact that, responding to the realities of who they are and not trying to push them into a particular model, that's going to give us the greatest odds of success. I want to say one final thing. In the yeshivish world, there's a great deal of talk that what is needed for the success of children is maternal prayers and maternal tears. That by mothers davening, saying tehillim, crying for the well-being of their children when they daven, when they bench lift, in all other settings, that is the way that guarantees or that ensures successful outcomes for your children. Without knocking the efficacy of intercessory prayer, which Judaism believes in, I'm not sure that I quite understand the causality of that. I'm not going to comment in on it one way or another, but I want to say this, that I do know about that. Okay, the verb hitpalel is a reflexive verb. It's a hitpael verb. It's a verb of you do something to yourself. Right? Lavash means war. Hitlabesh means got dressed. I dressed myself. So hitpalel is structured as a reflexive verb. And some have suggested that it's a verb related to the shorish pe lamed lamed, which is judgment or judging. And that what tefillah is actually meant to be is a kind of self-judgment, self-evaluation, self-assessment. It is a reflexive, I'm engaging with myself. In this case, I think that's actually very compelling. I think that perhaps davening for the success of our kids' outcomes in their education, in the formation as observant and committed Jewish adults, is not necessary. I mean, what Hashem does with my tefillot, that's not my concern. I'll let Hashem worry about Hashem. But it also forces me to stop and say, what do I think is the most important? What do I care the most about? What am I davening for? So if I'm not davening for that my kid get a higher SAT score or do better on their math test, which might be what my students are davening for, but I hope at least it's not what their parents are davening for. If I'm not davening for that my kid get a higher score on the math test or do better on the SATs or get into the college of their choosing, if ultimately what I'm davening for are the things that matter deeply the most to me, as a person, as a Jew, that I'm davening that I should have children, right, who are Ohev Hashem, Yirei Elokim, Zera Kodesh, if those are the things I'm davening for, that then shapes how I interact with my kids and what I say to them, and that I remember maybe among the 10,000 times that I said to pick up your stuff and do your homework and put your bowl in the sink, that I also remember to convey to them what my deeply held values are as a religious Jew and as a religious person. And also, reflecting on my most deeply held values stops me from getting sidetracked by the black hat or whatever is my equivalent of the black hat, by the thing that might seem to me very important in the moment but is actually relatively trivial in the scheme of things, and will keep me from getting into a fight with a challenging teenager about something that's really not worth expending my ammunition on and really not getting into a fight about. And so, again, leaving the question of what Hashem does with those tefillot to Hashem, I think the question of what we do with those tefillot is that we stop and we think about, what do I really want for my kids? Am I really conveying to my kids what I really want for my kids? Am I really conducting myself in a way that's maximally effective for ensuring that my kids achieve those outcomes? And so in this particular case, where it's so much about connecting back to those fundamental values and not getting sidetracked in all the day-to-dayness of the things that we talk about day-to-day, whether it's how you're doing in school or whether you picked your socks up off the floor, those moments of tefillah are actually moments for that kind of self-reflection, self-assessment, self-judging. What are the things I value and care about the most? And am I making sure that the messages that I give my kids, my interactions with my kids, are best aligned with those? And when we get back to that, connect to that, are able to do that, are able to be thoughtful about that, then we help create an environment in which we can reinforce and support what's going on with our children in their schools, and which we can do our best to ensure the greatest odds of a return on our tuition investment.